209 and commission hearing will commence again. Mr. Pearson, the reason I stopped is because I wanted to make sure that I was familiar with the motion, the prior motion that you referenced, and now that I know that I am, was your request to withdraw?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, then we grant that request.
Thank
okay,
you, Your Honor.
And I thank you for that, but I wanted to make sure it was fair to you because I didn't, if I granted something or not granted, I didn't want to prejudice anyone, so that's why I hesitated. So, thank you. The tenant appellant may therefore proceed with your case. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I would like to reserve 5 minutes.
5 minutes. Okay, sir. It's now 2:10, and Mr. Pearson, please begin.
As the court may be aware, there are in excess of a dozen errors noted in the notice of appeal that I filed. And so to facilitate our at least referring to the same issue during the course of this oral argument, I submitted a series of four charts that I'd like to organize at least my oral argument around. The first chart is with respect to rent overcharge claims. In this case, is captioned ALJ ignored the binding law on 5 writ claims. The second chart is with respect to the issue of treble damages in the case. The third chart is with respect to the issue of the notice to vacate in the case. And the final chart is with respect to the standard of review in this case, which is somewhat unusual because it was heard by a successor judge on the record as opposed to his hearing on live testimony. So in the absence of any questions from the court or direction to focus on a particular issue, I'll just proceed in chronological order, beginning with what I think is a foundational issue in this case, and that is with respect to the impact of the doctrine of void ab initio on the claim of exemption in this case. I cite the case of Fry versus Fry for the longstanding precedent in the District of Columbia that a document of any kind, whether it's a claim of exemption, a contract, a deed, if it's void ab initio, it has no legal effect at all without even the D.C. Court of Appeals has said as recently as 2010, without I even having filed a petition, the claim of exemption in this case would be deemed void ab initio if the landlord, as is uncontested in this case, failed to serve me with a copy or written notice of her claim of exemption prior to the beginning of my tenancy. That's an undisputed fact in this case, and as a matter of law, as a consequence, the administrative law judge erred in not finding all of the, in this case, 13 notices of rent increase to be void back to the very first one on December 1st, 2000. I've cited the case of Valiantos from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to regard to the effect specifically on statutes of limitations, that it tolls the time for running the statute of limitations. And certainly with respect to the Rental Housing Act's own internal statute of limitations, it was not triggered in light of the effect of the doctrine of void ab initio. The district's Rental Housing Act statute of limitations has really two trigger points that were not triggered in this case. One is it begins to run, rent adjustments can't, petitions challenging rent adjustments can't be brought more than 3 years after the rent adjustment becomes effective. In this case, we have neither a rent adjustment in a legal sense, nor do we have an effective date for a rent adjustment. And for the proposition that we don't even have a rent adjustment as a legal matter, I refer the court to 14 DCMR 4200.7. And it defines a rent adjustment as an increase or decrease in a rent that is authorized by the Rental Housing Act. In this case, it was not authorized because it rested on the assumption that the property was exempt from rent control.
I'd like to ask you a question real quick on that. In Hinman, the effective date, as we defined it under the statute of limitations, was the date that the rent was the rent payable was due, and so you're asking us now to reinterpret our definition of effective date as in other cases. And if you're doing so, then why would this case be? Why would this be an exception to a larger rule that's been established in other cases as to what effective date means?
The only definitive ruling I've come across on the meaning of effective date was by the court in Kennedy, District of Columbia Court of Appeals, in Kennedy versus Rental Housing Commission. And it said it varied depending on the context. The commission has not yet had before it, as far as my research establishes, the effect of the doctrine of void ab initio on the Rental Housing Act statute of limitations.
Now, Kennedy Kennedy was a case that applied to rent adjustments, not rent payments. And rent adjustment is typically viewed as a rent increase, and the rent payment is the payment of the actual rent. So I was just wondering, why wouldn't Kennedy... Isn't your whole argument predicated on rent payment rather than rent adjustment? You want to unroll this back to zero, which was the date of the first payment, not the date of the adjustment.
Well, first demand. I mean, within the meaning of both the penalty statute for the Rental Housing Commission entitles you to rent overcharges based upon the date of a demand, not a payment. And so the trigger date is either the rent adjustment or the date of the demand. And which are usually synonymous. And so that's what I'm basing my argument on, that there was no rent adjustment within the meaning of rent adjustment in the DCMR, and that there was no effective date because of the effect of the void ab initio doctrine, which nullifies for all time any document such as a claim of exemption from rent control or a notice of rent increase that's based upon a void document.
How do you respond to Judge Rodier is saying that taking this to its logical conclusion would essentially eradicate the statute of limitations as being at all effective in establishing any kind of rent adjustment in the past? You could unroll every rent adjustment back to zero, and you could challenge any rent adjustment from the very first day that it, you know, the illegality. Now, in what we did in Hinman was we said that, albeit there was an imperfected rent adjustment past the statute of limitations, it had to take effect within the 3-year period of the statute of limitations. So I was just wondering it was very limited to that. How do you counter Judge Rodier's statement that your interpretation would essentially eradicate any kind of statute of limitations limitation on damages?
Well, I think that he runs right up against the D.C. Court of Appeals decision in Levy versus Rental Housing Commission just 2 years ago in 2015, when the court expressly said that the commission's long-term interpretation of the effect of void ab initio was reasonable, that to enforce the requirement that a tenant be served either with a copy of the claim of exemption or with a copy of written notice of a claim to exemption, that it was reasonable as a consequence of not doing that for the document for that claim of exemption to be void ab initio. So the court expressly found that to be a reasonable interpretation of the powers under the D.C. Code for the commission to make that representation, make that interpretation. And it's been longstanding, Fry versus Fry, 85 years now in the District of Columbia, what the meaning of void ab initio means. So it's certainly not, he said it would lead to absurd consequences. It's not absurd. And the actual standard announced in Pareco versus Rental Housing Commission is whether it would lead to absurd consequences which the legislature could not have intended. And the legislature not only intended it to have that effect, but by the commission implementing it with a regulation that says the same thing, that it's not even a rent adjustment if it's not lawful. And then the court in 1986, just a year after the Rental Housing Act of 85 was enacted, doubled down on that by amending the penalty section to provide that if you willfully fail to disclose that information, you're also liable for a civil fine. Okay. And then in 2006, the D.C. Council amended the Rental Housing Act further to provide that if you fail to provide those disclosures after being given 10 written days notice of it, that the rent will be freeze forever. So the court, the D.C. Council, if we're looking to whether they intended this or not, they've actually gone much, much further than they did when they initially enacted the Rental Housing Act of 1985 to put teeth into the requirement that not only tenants of exempt properties, but tenants of all properties, that's what D.C. Code 4235.02.22 requires, a whole laundry list of disclosures for not just tenants of exempt properties or potentially exempt properties, but all rental properties in the District of Columbia.
All right. So, thank you. Go ahead.
So the effect of this is that it takes my entitlement to a rent refund back to the very first rent increase in December 1, 2000, through at least the date of the hearing in this case. The second issue is whether or not the landlord can cure the failure to provide pre-disclosure to a prospective tenant of an argued of their claim to exemption from rent control. And, of course, that's controlled by the commission's very recent decision, Smith Property Holdings versus Lutzko, decided just in 2015, where the court unequivocally laid to rest that contention. The third issue is whether or not the statute, or what the new rent is when exemption from rent control does not apply. The second issue in the case is whether what the new rent would be under rent control. And that's an issue that I promptly addressed after filing my tenant petition back in February of 2014. I immediately served a subpoena on the landlord, since obviously only the landlord knows about the prior rent history. And that's what you have to look to in determining what the appropriate rent is once a property loses its exemption from rent control and it becomes rent controlled. There are two relevant...
If I'm not mistaken, in an order that was issued by Judge Hine, I think in August, she specifically addressed some of the documents that you had requested through the use of a subpoena, denying some very specific documents. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, you chose not to ask for reconsideration, or you gave up the option to obtain those items. And I was curious.
Well, actually, my count was 9 times I raised the issue of 9 opportunities that the housing provider had to provide those issues, provide that information. First, I served a subpoena on February
28, 2014. No, I'm sorry. On August the 18th of 2014, she issued her order where she denied your request for those documents. And then during your hearing that you subsequently then had, I think it was in July, as various preliminary matters, she specifically reiterated that she was just going to make use of a 3-year statute of limitation, and then she proceeded to explain to you that she was not going to revisit any of the issues that she had addressed in her August 18th order, and you then clearly indicated that you were not asking for her to reconsider any of those things. So I'm very interested in how, if you decided to not revisit or ask her to reconsider her denial of your request for those documents, how you're able to make use of those arguments now.
Well, I re-raised it was the law of the case when she ruled on it. Mm-hmm. I'm bound by her ruling. And I also thought I had the burden of proof to prove the rent level. That's why I issued the subpoenas. And it wasn't until I ran across the case of Kirk Caruso.
That was after the hearing.
Right. After the hearing, I ran across the case of Camacho.
So explain to us how, if she made her ruling in August of 2014, mm-hmm. Then she reiterated her ruling in July of 2014.
Well, October, I think that was, actually.
In July of, you had an interim status where she, before you had the hearing, where you went over some preliminary matters. Remember, there was initially a hearing, and then it was continued. In September 2014. Okay. And at that time, you acknowledged, as you described here as the rule of the case, that you were not going to revisit any of those issues, and you weren't contesting her ruling with regard to your subpoena request. And then you had the entire hearing.
Right.
And your request to have the record remain open was denied. And then in March, you then proceed to file some documents with these new additional arguments. Explain to us how we are to treat your newly discovered evidence of cases that were quite old and completely accessible to you at the time that this case began, even in when you initially filed your pleadings in March of 2014, or even at the time you had your pre-hearing before the hearing started, how are we supposed to treat the use of those cases that you filed after the hearing was, after the record had closed?
Well, I haven't had the benefit of seeing the, I just realized there were transcripts of the evidentiary hearing in the record. I haven't had the benefit of reviewing the September the 11th, 2014 status conference and our communications regarding that. Just my off the top of the head response would be that if a judge makes a ruling, it's the law of the case. Mm-hmm. And so I'm bound by that ruling. I can appeal it at the conclusion of the case, which is what I did. And in this case, I not only appealed it at the end of the case, but I moved for reconsideration of it twice. I brought the Camacho case to her attention. I brought the Camacho case to the attention of the judge who succeeded her, and moved for reconsideration in light of the Camacho case. And at the conclusion of the, after he issued his final order, I then appealed it. So I did everything I think it was possible to do to bring that issue to her attention. And
so the filing of those motions were to bring those issues to her attention, or that was the precursor to your motion for reconsideration, which eventually was filed after the at some later date?
Well, initially I was wanting to bring it to the attention of the housing provider, because it ruled that the housing provider had the burden of proving it. I didn't have the burden of proving anything.
I see.
So this was to alert the housing provider, you need to reopen the record to put in evidence of what the base rent is under rent control. And then I really have 6 months after the housing provider presents that proof from which to challenge it. That's this special statute of limitations for challenges to base rents in 4200.2.
I interrupted you. Please continue with your arguments.
So on 8 different occasions, by motion or otherwise, the landlord had the opportunity to meet her burden of proving what the rent under base rent under rent control would be in the same proceeding. And as I said, so she did, in response to my subpoena, in response to my motion to compel, I listed in my pre-hearing memo, post-hearing notice that I filed. Judge Hines, who actually conducted the hearing, had decided the case of Hardy versus Sigalas, in which she looked at the prior rent of the prior tenant to determine what the new base rent would be under rent control. And so I thought especially that Judge Hines would be, you know, sua sponte if want to reopen the record. But certainly the landlord would.
Camacho was a case that I really don't understand as being precedent for anything. Camacho was a hotel type case that was there was no evidence at all offered of registration, none. I mean, it was a case that it was sounded like a rooming house, and that was what the certificate of occupancy said, rooming house. And so, I find the Camacho argument to be extremely weak, personally, because it's so different on the facts from this case. Here, there was a registration on file. There's evidence in the record of a registration in Camacho. The court even said, could you provide any evidence, any whatsoever, of a base rent, anything, and the gentleman was unable to do it. Here, there was evidence, as opposed in the record, there was a exemption on file in 1997, if I'm not mistaken. So I don't see how Camacho can serve as precedent outside of a very, very limited kind of factual situation that in which there was the facts suggest that it was a hotel or rooming house that someone wanted to convert to more than a, you know, to a 30-day type residence for someone that was unable to pay it. So I'm just wondering, please persuade me that Camacho is good precedent for this case.
Okay. Now, the commonality between Camacho and this case is that the commission, where the issue came before it, of the housing provider's failure to respond to subpoenas. Same thing here. I immediately served subpoenas trying to get information about prior tenants so that the hearing examiner ALJ could set a new base rent under rent control. I was frustrated. So was the tenant in the Camacho case. We were both also frustrated because the hearing examiner would not compel, when we filed motions to compel, would not compel the housing provider to provide that information. In the Camacho case, it was the rent level as of, I think it's September 1, 1983, under the 1980 Rental Housing Act. In my case, it would be the rent as of, I think it's September 1st, 1985. Plus any lawful increases since then. We're both trying to get information from the housing provider who's the sole repository for that information, either orally, based on her memory, or based on records. And so when Camacho, the tenant in Camacho, appealed to the Rental Housing Commission, they compelled the landlord to produce that evidence. They remanded the case so the landlord would have another opportunity to produce that evidence. The landlord, or housing provider, had initially said he did have the records. Then when it got remanded, he said he didn't have the records. In any event, he was the best person to produce that information, so the commission ruled that if he failed to produce that evidence on remand, that he authorized the hearing examiner to set the rent level at zero, since nobody else had that information.
I'm not sure that I didn't authorize. I understand where you're coming from now. You're talking much more about the failure to respond to a subpoena with a base rent, I just find it to be, personally, I'm not persuaded by Camacho in this case, but I see where you're coming from. You're coming more from the subpoenas and the failure to respond to subpoenas for certain rent information. Base rent information. I think that's would correct. Probably be where you're drawing. Has. Yeah, you're drawing that. I see, sir. Okay.
That only the landlord has. You know, it's a well-known evidentiary
gotcha.
Principle.
I got gotcha. You. And we got two more minutes. I'll give you two because we did ask you a lot of questions, sir. So if you could, you know, just
and special discretion stands for the same proposition. The landlord has the burden of proving the base rent. When he frustrates it, certainly right. it should be.
I got you. I got you. Okay, thanks.
Issue
that's
number four okay. is the 10-day opportunity to cure. I've set out the many opportunities that the landlord had to my exhibit 114, 115 gave her that opportunity. She didn't. Fifth is the Levy case, which respects my repeated request to reopen the record so that I could bring up to date in light of the delay, 2-year delay in deciding the case below, evidence that she's continuing to demand rent of $1,386 per month. On trouble damages, I've listed with the exhibits the 8 different occasions after I brought to her attention specific code provisions that held that she had discharged me an unlawful rent. And so that is the basis for, under the standard of heedless disregard, which Judge Vergeer noticed but didn't apply to the facts of the case. He noticed the standard was whether she continued to heedlessly disregard her obligation under rent control, and yet he didn't apply it to the undisputed facts of the case. Same thing with respect to the Camacho case. After I brought to her attention that the rent should be rolled back to zero, I should be entitled to a trouble damages beginning on the date I did that, March 19, 2016. With respect to notice, the key issue, I think, with respect to the 90-day notice is what is the definition of willful? And I cite the case of which the administrative law judge did not acknowledge, B.F. Saul Property versus Nelson, February 18, 2016 decision of the commission. You reaffirmed that intent is inferred if a housing provider should have known he was violating an obligation. Here, the 90-day notice itself told the landlord that you have to serve it at least 90 days before the date that you put down for eviction, told her that you have 5 days within which to file it with the rent administrator. So it's just for sophisticated landlords, it's the one we have in this case, it's as a matter of law. That was a demonstration of willfulness.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you, sir. And you will reserve 5 minutes. Thank you for answering our questions, and I thank you for clarifying Camacho to me where you're coming from. Now it makes a lot more sense. Okay. Thanks. Ms. Haney?
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd first like to address the issue that Mr. Pearson spent much of his time discussing, which is what he calls the void ab initio argument, or the failure to provide a disclosure before the lease is signed. And I wanted to clarify a couple of things, because I think there's been a little bit of muddiness in the order about this. DC Code 42-3502.05D provides that a written notice of exemption is required. It does not provide that the actual claim of exemption is required, and I don't know how significant this fact is, but it is a fact. So when we say pre-leasing disclosure, what we have to be talking about is failure to put in writing that the property is exempt from rent control, as opposed to failing to provide the actual claim of exemption. DC Code 42-3502.22 does actually provide that you have to provide the claim of exemption, but that statute wasn't enacted until 2006, at which point Mr. Pearson had already been living in this property for 7 years. And so I think that his interpretation of the effect of failure to comply with DC Code 42-3502.22 is incorrect. But I also think that we don't need to reach that issue in this case, because it really isn't presented on these facts, because at the time the property was leased, that statute didn't exist. Yes, there was an obligation to provide a notice of disclosure. So the question then becomes, does the violation of DC Code 42-3502.05D carry with it some penalty that's different than the violation of the regulation providing that contemporaneous notice must be given when a claim of exemption is filed, which clearly is another thing that the Judge Vergeer found my client didn't do. In Butler versus Toy, the issue of the pre-leasing disclosure was discussed in tandem with the failure to provide a contemporaneous copy of the claim of exemption, which was filed later on. And in the commission stated in that case that the claim of exemption remains void until proper notice is received by the tenant. And that strongly suggests to me that the failure to provide notice is curable. Whether the notice is the 3502.05D, or whether it is the contemporaneous claim of exemption form under the DC regulations under 4101.6. In Levy, in the commission's decision, well, I think the only issue that was under discussion, if I recall correctly, was the failure to provide a contemporaneous copy of the claim of exemption. But there again, the commission said that this failure was curable, and even specifically stated how. And Judge Vergeer relied on that in his decision and essentially instructed my client that she could file an amended claim of exemption and serve it properly. And she did that within a week after the final order was made. And so and I think that cures the pre-leasing disclosure. I'm aware of the commission's decisions that emphasize that the tenant should have the right before leasing up to decide whether they want to live in a place that's exempt from rent control, and that's a fair point. But the commission's decisions also emphasize that once a tenant has become a month-to-month tenant, that decision could be made any month. And in this case, Mr. Pearson's been a month-to-month tenant for 17 years. And so at any time, he had the opportunity to make a different decision about where he would like to live. The other aspect of this, what is characterized as the void ab initio argument, again contains a little slip. Mr. Pearson argues that the claim of exemption is void ab initio, and the case law clearly says that. But then the missing piece is, he says the rent increases are void ab initio, because the claim of exemption is void ab initio. And there's no support for that in the law. His claim is that the rent reverts back automatically, that they were, because the claim of exemption was invalid, each one of these rent increases is invalid and reverts back to the pre-increase rent automatically. This is inconsistent with the statute of limitations, as is pointed out in Kennedy. And and also the essential structure of the act, which I think, as the court in Kennedy pointed out, is not self-enforcing, that all of the projected inequities that allegedly come from an error far in the past affecting current day's rent, a conscious decision was made by the legislature to cut that off for 3 years.
How do you respond to the appellant's argument about Camacho?
Well, I think that we can start from the proposition that in Camacho, the housing provider claimed not to be exempt under the Act, but to be excluded from the Act, which is different, as the court at this commission noted in Sendar versus Burke. It's a different situation. And so the scope of coverage would be much broader in the case of a tenant claiming exemption. But in Camacho, all the commission said was, on remand, if the housing provider, who the court found was a housing provider, and there, based on the evidence that was not presented and that finding was not disturbed, but on remand, that if the party didn't provide the requested information, then the hearing officer should exercise his discretion to call the rent zero. That is not a mandate that the rent is zero if the tenant doesn't provide certain information. And in this case, Judge Hines was correct in holding that, in applying the statute of limitations. If you cannot challenge a rent increase that has taken effect more than 3 years in the past, then what possible benefit could there be in going all the way back to before 1997 to find out what, if any, rent was charged to any prior tenants? There's no evidence in this record that there were ever any prior tenants. The facts here are that Ms. Brown bought this condominium new. This was new construction in 1986. She bought it new. And she lived in it for a while. There's no evidence that she rented it to anybody. I don't know whether she did or she didn't. But this is just...
What if the evidence indicates, based on some testimony presented by your opponent, that anecdotally, through your client, a relative had previously resided in there, that he describes to Ms. Hines, he knows this through an anecdotal conversation about her previous practice of evicting people. And so anecdotally, there was some testimony never confirmed by your client or asked about some relative that had previously resided in the same location that she had asked to leave because of failing to pay 1 month's worth of rent. That's the only anecdotal information.
Well, I don't see how that provides, I don't see how that changes any of the structure of this lawsuit, which is it's still so far in the past that even if that's true, what bearing does it have on this? It has none. And I won't even get into the morass of what happens when one rents to relatives. But that's so far divorced from the situation that was presented in Camacho, which ended up being really a case about wrongful eviction. Eventually, and so what we're talking about is something very, very different. I mean, this is a person who actually did file a claim of exemption, as the court has already pointed out. With regard to the issue of effective date, I was happy to hear the court point to the Hinman case, because in my reading of Hinman, there is a specific definition of what effective date means. And I think that it was cited by Judge Vergeer, and it was properly applied in this case.
I've got two questions before
sure.
you go. I was just reminded that now might be a good time to ask. One, there was a claim of untimely cross appeal, and it was based on an email notices that apparently went to HaneyLaw.com, but were claimed that you didn't receive it. Is that was a matter of, I mean, that's a factual statement. That's a matter of possibly contested fact, but it's impossible to contest. What exactly happened? Can I ask what your claim is about the timeliness of your cross appeal?
Well, I did not receive an email regarding, I did not receive the order by email. I got into this case many years after the actual hearing, and I was not, I don't, there was an issue with regard to me receiving things, because, and this was brought up at the status hearing with Judge Vergeer after the original order issued, the preliminary order. I didn't receive it by email. If I had received it by email, I would have filed the notice of appeal according to that, because I do believe that if you receive it by email, then you probably ought to go with that and not take the chance. But I didn't. I don't know why it has that postmark date. I mean, I can recall bringing the notice down here. I believe that I did it from my house because of the way the envelope is, and I don't understand why it says December 24th. I just don't know. I cannot specifically tell you that I recall putting it in the mailbox, but I can tell you that based on what the envelope looks like, and the fact that I would have done it from my home office, my normal practice would have been to use the mailbox that's at the end of my street. And I cannot tell you, I specifically recall going down there on that day. But that's why I don't sign the certificates of service of the copies that go to my opponent until after it's been put in the mail, so that I can always say, it's not just signed off on, if that makes any sense.
But in the record, there is a substitution of counsel, one-page precipice.
Yes.
And the information contained in there and the contact information includes that D. Dehaney, I forget, that is an accurate email.
Dehaney at dehaneylaw.com. That is certainly my email address.
And that's the same email address that appeared in the final order when it indicated mail and email. Those are the same emails, correct?
I believe so. I received it in the mail and not by email, so...
Yeah, I mean, notwithstanding in the final order indicates that you would have been identified as receiving a courtesy copy, although at the time that the final order was issued, it's clear that the judge below would have known that you had substituted out.
They should have known that, and it does say that. It does say a courtesy copy. Oh, no, this is incorrect. This is incorrect. Where it says courtesy copy, it says dhaney at haneylaw.com. It's dhaney at dhaneylaw.com.
Do you have a copy of the precipice that you filed, essentially?
I do not have that with me.
All right, very well. If those two email addresses are the same, then there's... If the email address on the actual document you filed with the court indicating that you substituted yourself for the previous trial counsel, and that's the same email address that appears on Judge Regeer's final order, there's not much more we can do.
I understand. I just don't. I can't think why it would say that.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's okay. That's I've been puzzled about this for a long time, and when I looked at it here, I could see it's not the correct email address. I would hope that I put the correct email address on my precipice, but since I don't have it here, I can't.
Second question I have, if I might, is about Capusta. What? Why is it unfair to apply Capusta here?
Well, this is a very specific situation, and one of the things that I noticed in preparing for this is that the statute now says knowingly demanding, which is different than what it was under prior law. That's one thing. And here, Ms. Brown didn't ask for any of the... I mean, the Judge Zeldin set the protective order in the landlord-tenant case at 1320. Ms. Brown was pro se at the time. She may not have been pro se at the time. I may be wrong about that. This was before I got involved. But she did not object to that. And so, for all intents and purposes, during the entire pendency of this petition, at least so far, he has not been, that 1386 has not been demanded of him in the sense that he would face eviction if he didn't pay it. I do understand that if this case would have gone forward, then we could have argued that the actual 1386 could have been demanded. But under the factual circumstances of this case, that never happened. And that's the reason, is that the court order temporarily superseded any demands my client may have made, which is why I'm not asking that the rent increase be award be overturned for the months he didn't pay. I understand that is the law. And when the court addressed the issue when housing providers would raise the issue of unfairness with regard to a tenant who hasn't paid any rent at all, the response was, and this makes sense, the landlord has the ability to sue the tenant for the rent that isn't paid. And so for the months that weren't paid at all, her remedy is to sue him for the unpaid amount. And so she just is not going to recover the increases, or they're going to be awarded back against her. And that I understand. But that option's taken away once there's a protective order in effect. And as a practical matter, the parties have been unable to undo any of it since it went into effect. I mean, the pendency of this appeal has stopped any kind of – we tried. Mr. Pearson filed motions, and so did I, after the final order in this case. And Judge Zeldin wasn't going to change anything because the case is still over here. So in the landlord-tenant court, it is stayed pursuant to Drayton, and she's not going to take any action with respect to the protective order or anything else until that stay is removed. And this is a unique set of circumstances where the entire time that the decision that we're awaiting decision through the final order, he's paying into protective order at a lower amount. So, I mean, the underlying basis really to me is that he was never under threat of eviction for not paying that amount. And so, and my client was not demanding that amount. She didn't try to get the protective order raised, and she essentially let it be the way it is. And I do understand that what I'm asking this court to do is go beyond or make an exception to a line of existing case law, and that is deliberate. Mr. Pearson raised in his brief my failure to raise this as an exception in the court below, and that was deliberate because I'm not saying that any of the facts that were found were incorrect. What I'm saying is that a modification or an exception to the law should be made in this case, and I really think that, if it's going to happen, needs to come from the commission, not from the not from Judge Regeer, who was following existing law clearly. And I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that. I'm just saying I'm advocating for a change in the law with respect to this particular limited set of circumstances.
And my last question is, Mr. Pearson also talks about bad faith and raises even a question of retaliation. And it doesn't seem to have been reached by the court, by the judge below. And I was just wondering, do you think that the court accurately and adequately addressed the issue of bad faith with respect to the trebling of damages?
Yes, I do. I think that the reason that the issue of retaliation was not reached as an issue of retaliation is because Mr. Pearson made a deliberate decision to parcel out the issue of retaliation and put it in separate petitions where it was raised. And he actually assigns as error in this lawsuit the Judge Vergeer's making of findings that bear on the issue of retaliation, even though there's nothing in this decision that makes a decision on any claim of retaliation. Clearly, Mr. Pearson's first email to my client challenging the rent increase in 2013 dealt almost exclusively, not exclusively, but almost exclusively with his claim of retaliation. But he didn't make that claim in these two tenant petitions. He didn't make that claim in the third tenant petition. It's in the fourth tenant petition in 3767 that retaliation claim comes out. So, here, you know, the issues of bad faith and retaliation, these are related issues, but And I will tell you that I made a motion for summary judgment with regard to Mr. Pearson's retaliation claim on the very grounds that he failed to include all of his claims in these petitions. But with respect to the issue of bad faith, Judge Vergeer decided the issues that were put in front of him. Mr. Pearson actually claims that he went too far and decided and tried to decide the issues of retaliation and decided them against him when he was precluded from entering evidence with regard specific regard to retaliation. I don't read it that way. I think that the findings that were made that bear on the issue of bad faith were necessary to two things. Number one, going to my client's motive with respect to filing the 90-day notice for personal use and occupancy, and number two, with regard to her motivation for raising the rent. The rent increase in 2013 was it was larger than the other ones. If you look throughout the whole course of that one, was bigger than the other ones, and even though he didn't raise retaliation with respect to that issue, he did raise bad faith, and he has consistently claimed that my client has acted willfully and in bad faith with respect to these with all the increases. But I think that most of the evidence of that is not really undisputed. Is he claims that she's acting in bad faith and acting willfully because he told her that it was wrong. And I don't know that that's the standard. I don't know that the standard was adequately for willfulness anyway was adequately quoted by Mr. Pearson. I think that in the Bernstein case, the court looked at the two different standards that had been presented in the past and went with the stricter one, and stated, as other cases have, that the housing provider, in order to act willfully, must be aware that that she's violating the law. And certainly in Bernstein, that was true. I represented Belinda Shepherd, so I remember the housing provider in that case tried to raise, instead of raising the rent by just a ceiling adjustment that he had stored up, decided he could just raise it to the ceiling. This is the large management company with lawyers to advise him. Yes, he knew what he was doing was wrong, and he got over on the tenant. That's not what's happening here.
Do you have any, let me just, we're running out of time. Do you have any questions, Judge?
I just want to be clear for the housing provider. Could you just speak to whether you felt that below the tenant did have a specific burden of proof with establishing whether the statute of limitations A did apply, and whether you think within the confines of the hearing before Judge Hines that the your client was able to meet that standard of proof?
Well, I think that the statute of limitations applies as a matter of law. I don't see anything in the law that supports an argument that it can be avoided because of any of the arguments that have been made. But I will be honest, I wasn't at the hearing, so I don't know whether it was raised or whether it was raised in any specific way. But I do believe that It does appear to me, looking back on it, that Judge Hines was aware of the 3-year statute of limitations, that she applied it even in discovery questions, and that Judge Vergeer was certainly aware of it. And if it's going to have any meaning at all, it has to simply apply as this commission has interpreted it. And she did present evidence of her notices of rent increase. Or he presented evidence of those. There's evidence in the record of all the notices of rent increase since he was a tenant. So it can be determined what the effective date is under Hinman. And I know I'm running out of time. I just like
sorry,
to say
that's the only question I have.
Okay.
Yeah, just finish up. Give you another minute or so just
okay.
to finish
well,
up.
Well, just in summing up, I want to say that you may or may not be aware, I've had the privilege of representing tenants in actions before this commission for many, many years. And I'm not representing a tenant in this case, obviously, but I have. And in that time, I've had a lot of I've seen a lot of commission decisions that actually helped preserve the fund of affordable housing and enforce the Rental Housing Act as it was written in the District of Columbia, and that really made a difference. But that's not what's happening here. What's happening here is turning the Rental Housing Act on its head. Considering what is being argued here is that Mr. Pearson should be allowed to live in this property forever without paying any rent, zero rent, and with no opportunity for the housing provider to change that. A woman who owns one condo, that's it, one condo. That cannot be what the Act was designed to do. And I think that if it were interpreted in that way, in the unlikely event it were interpreted that way, that the effect on the affordable housing in this city would be insidious but real. Many, many, many people like Ms. Brown rent units. And this unit, you can see from the evidence that's summarized in the final order, was affordable. It was affordable. It's not a subsidized housing unit, but it was affordable. And these small landlords who try but fail to comply with all the laws, if they're going to be penalized to the point of being ruined, then why would they ever rent their units? How is that going to affect tenants in the District of Columbia? I just think that what's being asked here is way beyond the pale, and I would simply ask that you dismiss Mr. Pearson's appeal. And I thank you for using your 5 minutes.
Mike, did you have any questions?
No questions.
Okay. Yeah, I know. Okay, no other questions? Yes, sir. Go ahead. You've got 5 minutes, please.
I would simply ask that you dismiss Mr. Pearson's appeal. No law, no facts. Just dismiss it, because in any event, the housing providers failed to pay the amount ordered by OH, $9,762. She has not applied for a stay of that order. She has not posted a bond. She hasn't paid it into an approved escrow account. And so under 14 DCMR 3805.6 in my cross brief, I request that the commission strike her cross appeal or dismiss her cross appeal and refer the matter for noncompliance to the OAH for assessment of a civil fine as authorized by DC Code Title 423509.01B4. Just as a preliminary matter, her appeal, her cross appeal, not only untimely, not only filed without giving Judge Vergeer an opportunity to address the issues that she raised, despite his giving us a month in which to do so, also has not been attended by the required escrow or bond or payment. Beginning with, I think, all of her legal claims have no merit. She said that, for example, I wasn't required to be served with an actual copy of the claim of exemption. That's contradicted by DC Code Section 4202.05H. It requires that I be served with a copy of the claim of exemption in this case, contemporaneously with my moving in or before I moved in. It's undisputed in this case that I was not served with an actual copy of the claim of exemption, in addition to not being served with a written statement of any claim of exemption from rent control. She argued that DC Code Section 423502.22 was not enacted until 2006. I'll refer the court to the case of Schultz Partnership versus Rental Housing Commission, where the DC Court of Appeals said that the court would apply the law in effect at the time that the tenant petition was filed. The tenant petition was filed in 1994. The tenant petition was filed in 2013, well after the Rental Housing Act was amended. And the portion that I attempted to enforce was not the obligation, but the cure requirement in it. That she had 10 days to cure after I notified her of the statute and the obligation she had failed to discharge. And she failed 10 days within a 10-day period after that. And then I sent her another notice about it as well a few weeks after that. On neither occasion did she exercise her opportunity to cure, and that's what triggers the operation of the sanctions in that statute. Respect to Butler versus Choi, I think it's just common sense that you can't cure as to a prospective tenant when he's no longer a prospective tenant but an actual tenant. You know, you can't, unless you can reverse engineer time, that's impossible to cure. And I thought I explained in my opening statement that the D.C. Council not only intended that effect, but it has doubled down, tripled down since 1985. With respect to month-to-month tenancy, she argued Habib versus Thurston, 517 Atlantic 2nd, 1 on page 4, I think it's footnote 5, says that there are no month-to-month tenancies in the District of Columbia now as a matter of statutory law. You have an indeterminate tenancy. Because the Rental Housing Act of 1985 prohibits landlords from evicting you at the end of your contract or original lease term. You're now a tenant for the rest of your life. In fact, I think the court referred, the commission, in one of its decisions referred to as a life tenancy subject to an indeterminate, if you violate some provision in the Rental Housing Act, then it can be served with a notice to vacate and your tenancy terminated for that. But otherwise, every tenant in the District of Columbia has an indeterminate tenancy, not a month-to-month, not a year-to-year, but a statutory tenancy. With respect to the notice of increase, not that the, she appears to concede that the claim of exemption is not valid, but she argues that the notice of increase that was based on it is not valid. There's no authority for that. I cited Free versus Free, which says exactly that, that because in that case, the divorce decree was invalid, the subsequent marriage was invalid as well. So when the husband manufactured grounds for securing a divorce by fraud in Virginia and then came to D.C., his resulting marriage to his new wife was similarly invalid. It's a well-established principle of void ab initio. So there is law, 85-year standing, with respect to that question. She argued that Camacho was not... not a mandate for the result that I'm reaching. This is far more egregious than facts in Camacho. In Camacho, you had two opportunities to present the evidence that the housing provider did not. In my case, you have eight instances. I repeatedly brought this issue up on motion for reconsideration, notice of the Camacho decision, exceptions, etc., eight different times. Finally, it doesn't matter if the final order by Judge McGeer was sent to the wrong email address. The remedy for that is to file a motion for extension of time so that you could have an extended period of time which to note your appeal. She didn't take that option. And so as a matter of law, the commission doesn't have the power to now extend the time for her. Finally, with respect to standard for bad faith, in Cascade Park Apartments versus Walker, January 14, 2005, decision of the commission, you rule that bad faith is a standalone standard. Bad faith is a continuing heedless disregard of a duty. You cited a 1990 case. So this has been the law at the commission level for over 25 years that you cannot heedlessly disregard your duty that in this case was brought to your attention repeatedly. I not only brought it to your attention, but I referred it to Free, you know, the housing ombudsman at DHCD, a lot of different free sources gave her the links to them. I wasn't asking her to take my word at all, but to get it from a neutral, free third party. And if that isn't a heedless disregard of a duty repeatedly over a 16-year period of time, I just don't know what it is.
Sure, I think you did. You certainly raised a lot of the issues that or challenged a lot of the issues that were in the appellee's case. Do you have any questions?
Yes.
Do you have
no
any
questions?
Very good. Well, that brings to end today's hearing. We certainly intend to issue a decision within 30 to 45 days. I greatly appreciate both sides and the quality of your arguments. And we will endeavor to meet our time requirements, which we've done pretty successfully. So I thank you for attending and all the people here for attending. And it's now at
307.
Okay, and we are adjourned.
Thank you, Your Honor.
It may have been.
He did excellent.
I bet you he did. Maybe like just the magic of your seat.
He had a full command.
He had commanded it, the language and everything.
But were there a whole lot of folks?
There were.